evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is glass artist Steve Gibbs. Gibbs began his career in glass at age 12 when he started working in his uncle's studio in Elmira, New York. He worked for 17 years as a manager at Steuben Glass before joining the staff at the Corning Museum of Glass in 1998. Gibbs has been a creative force behind many of the museum's highly popular events, including the Hot Glass Show and the subsequent Hot Glass Roadshow. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. I'm having fun in Ithaca today.
That's great. Now you began working in glass in 1970 at your uncle's studio. Now, was this a family business you were expected to go into, or were you really interested in this?
Well, I've always been very interested in glass and always been very aware of glass. My parents were glass collectors, and they also kind of did it as a side business. They bought and sold art glass. Also, my uncle Lyman, from the time I was an infant, I can remember walking around and hearing shards of glass crinkle under my feet as I made my way through his stained glass studio that he had set up in his garage. And my uncle Lyman made his living making stained glass windows for churches and businesses all over the Northeast beginning in the 1930s.
Mm.
So I've always had a deep interest in glass, and yes, it always has been a family kind of business, something I've always been exposed to since I was really an infant.
Now, you were making stained glass when you first started. Were people actually bringing designs, or were you actually able to exercise some creativity and create designs?
It was actually a little bit of both. I was fortunate in that my uncle Lyman in Elmira had a thriving stained glass business and was doing very well. And he was always somewhat secretive about his stained glass work. I think it was kind of a throwback to the old days of the guilds and the European tradition of not freely sharing the knowledge of the guild until someone was maybe fully absorbed in an apprenticeship. Well, I was fortunate. My uncle Lyman kind of took a liking to me, and he began training me in his studio, and over the course of 3 or 4 years showed me kind of the tricks of the trade, I guess you would say. So I really enjoyed that, and my uncle Lyman certainly had his own designs that he was doing, but he was also an astute enough teacher to allow me the freedom every once in a while to exercise my own designs. So my pieces used to be somewhat different than the ones he would do in typical liturgical type of work. The faces of the figures would have flesh-like tones. And many times my Uncle Lyman and I would debate a great deal about my freelance approach. And many times the faces would not have traditional flesh tones, or the hands might not be flesh tones. The various things might take on kind of a surreal kind of coloration, and almost, I think, a more expressionistic type of expression, where it was more about the color and less about depicting reality.
Mm-hmm. Now, is blowing glass and using color with glass, are those two separate arts, or is that something you have to learn all at the same time?
Well, they can really become intertwined with one another. For a long, long time, when I started blowing glass, I've always been very drawn to using all kinds of bright, vibrant color. And really, most glass artists do have a great deal of knowledge in working in both clear glass and in color. The color of glass, and one of the things that makes glass color unique, is that many of the colors, especially the transparent, not only reflect light, they also transmit light to your eye.
Mm.
Unlike a painting or a sculpture where most of the light is reflected, with glass, the light is transmitted. And I think human beings kind of have a natural propensity or kind of drawn to that vibrant, transmitted color that glass is able to deliver to your eye.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us what glass exactly is? I know it's considered a liquid, isn't it?
Well, glass can be liquid. It's a very mysterious material. Most glass at about 905 degrees Fahrenheit begins to soften. Glass doesn't actually melt, it softens. It follows a viscosity curve and gets more and more fluid as the temperature of the glass rises. Most of the time when we're working with glass, we work with it at about 2,100 degrees, and at that temperature, the glass has about the same viscosity as common table honey. One of the things that we often hear, especially when I was working with stained glass, is that glass flows over time.
Mm.
And really, that's kind of an old wives' tale. Most of the physicists that I've talked to, most of the ceramic engineers, there's never been a viable demonstration that I'm aware of where glass has actually been demonstrated to flow. At the Corning Museum of Glass, we do have some of the oldest glass items in the world. We have one that's between 3,500 and 4,000 years old. It's a piece, a little medallion of an Egyptian prince called Amenhotep. And Amenhotep shows no evidence of flowing at room temperature after, you know, well over 3,000 years. So really, we're not sure that it does flow unless it's heated a great deal and gets above about 900 degrees Fahrenheit.
Let's talk about the creative process, though. When you're thinking of a design or some kind of a concept for a piece of glass, do you draw it out or do you plan it on paper first?
Many times, yes. I come from a background where I did a great deal of oil painting 20 years ago, and so I tend to paint my sketches out with all kinds of vibrant color because I think it's fun and I really enjoy that. So I tend to paint things. The other tradition that has been alive for hundreds or even thousands of years is for glassmakers to draw on the floor of the shop with a stone or a tool or today with chalk. So I love to have a little bit of chalk handy. In fact, I plan on working in the next few days. And when I do, I'll be working with other assistants. Glass is not something you usually do on your own. It's something where you have to direct others to work with you to do it, which is part of the fun, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be drawing out drawings on the floor so that I can direct other people and say, I'd like you to little more curve here. We're going to put a little more glass in this area. So yes, drawing is often involved, and that's not true for all artists. When I work with the Corning Museum, we work with different artists from around the world, and many of the glass artists are able to think and have ideas come to fruition only by having it in their mind and then realizing it on the end of a blowpipe. So it's kind of a mix. I would say the traditional approach is to draw it out, but more and more today, I work with many artists that come and do guest appearances at the Corning Museum of Glass, and sometimes it's a bit confusing because we'll ask them to draw, and they say, well, really, we don't draw. We just like to realize it on the end of the pipe. So it demands a little bit of flexibility with a team, depending on the artist that you're working with.
How much leeway does an artist have if you are blowing something and it's not working out?
Well, certainly, one of the things that I think is very important to understand is that with glass, the average apprenticeship is about 6 years. Glass is a trade or a form of artistry or craft that requires many years to learn, and it's kind of an oral tradition. Glassmakers learned how to blow glass on the end of a blowpipe about 2,000 years ago. And that lineage or that sense of passing the word down from generation to generation has always happened kind of verbally. So you have to understand the limits of what the materials are. And with glass, if you heat it up a little bit too much, if the form is a little bit too thin, if it's a little bit too heavy in the wrong area, the material will very quickly tell you what's possible and what isn't. And one of the interesting things about glass is typically when it does fail, it's not a subtle failure. Mm. It fails catastrophically. We all know that glass breaks. If we heat it up too much, it'll collapse. If you blow too much, you can literally blow a piece to the point that it will actually rupture as you blow it. So the material will very quickly communicate to the maker what the constraints of the materials are, if you're ready to listen, and most people are.
So glass blowing, in some ways, is the tradition like storytelling.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I really enjoy is that there are still, you know, in this modern age, so many things have been mechanized, and certainly most of the glass that we have in our homes today, bottles, windows, all those types of glass objects are made by machine. But there are still many, many processes with glass that cannot be done by a machine. We need people to do that, and that's one of the things I really enjoy. And I also enjoy this sense that really, when we look at depictions of glass that was happening 1,500, 1,000 years ago, 300, 500 years ago, when we look at the tools that those people used, those glassmakers, they're pretty much the same tools that we use today on our bench. So it's this sense of tradition, and especially the sense of oral traditions through apprenticeships. It's only in the last really 30 years that books have been written on how to blow glass, and I would not want to be the individual that reads a book and then has to learn how to blow glass. It's really something that's best learned under the tutelage or under the wing of a knowledgeable master. The concept of working as an apprentice and repeating something over and over again and building a body of knowledge from the simplest types of tasks up to the most complex are really the best way to learn.
Mm-hmm. And can this profession be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing?
Glass can definitely be dangerous. The good thing is we are very aware of the dangers. Now, with the Corning Museum of Glass, on the Hot Glass Show that we do every day, both in Corning and around the world, we have never had what our friends at OSHA would call a lost time accident. We've never had an accident where someone has lost any kind of work. Small abrasions, small burns, cuts are infrequent, but from time to time they do happen. But if you are being seriously injured or you are being hurt, something is wrong. It's a problem and it needs to be addressed immediately. Probably the best protection that we have in a glass shop, be it at the Corning Museum of Glass or anywhere else we work in the world, would be knowledge and people and awareness. One of the great things about working with glass is that you work in a team. Mm. And it's always very important. Everybody is always looking out for each other. If you notice a blowpipe is getting warm or you find sense that something is hot or any type of danger, we always call it out to each other immediately and we take immediate corrective action because when you get burnt or when you get cut, it hurts. Mm-hmm. And we hate that.
Now, I understand that you are a big fan of the Impressionists and the colors and the work that they did. And you try to incorporate that into some of your glass work. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how you do that.
Well, I've always been seduced by color, I guess I would say, in bold color. And especially when it's combined with the emotion of a spontaneous kind of brushstroke on a painting or the addition of what we would call a small bit of glass to a larger piece of glass. And in glassmaking, just like in painting we have many different bristles of brushes and different thicknesses of paint that we can apply. And with glass, it's very much the same way. We can put little particles of glass, different colors, mix them together and apply them. We can pull them out into long strings called cane and apply them so that the work develops more of a linear kind of feel. We can drizzle the glass around, much like Jackson Pollock would have drizzled paint around on a canvas, you know, many years ago. So I think that we can not only have vibrant color within a piece of glass, but we can also elicit emotion and motion and movement within a piece by the way the glass is applied. And many times glass makers seen working the way they move around each other in usually a fairly graceful way, it's also often likened to the choreography of a dance.
Mm.
I think that that's true. And I think many times that choreography of that movement, if you can capture that in the way that a piece is being blown and color is being applied to a piece of glass, you can really elicit a sense of motion along with the color. So it's kind of the double whammy of glass, color and motion.
Mm, that's a really fascinating way of putting it. Which brings me to my next question. Is there debate in the glassmaking community, like there is in the photography community and elsewhere, about whether glassmaking is really an art or is it a trade?
Well, I think it can be both. And of course, the debate rages on and has for centuries and probably still will. I think more and more in the United States, glass is being seen as an art form in many ways. It's only in the last 30 years or so that glass has really come to the hands of artists. Glass was always a very industrial endeavor. It was done on a huge scale, producing commodities like bottles and window glass and drinking vessels, that type of thing. It wasn't until the late 1960s, early 1970s, when glass really became available on a small scale to independent artists in the United States and around the world. And really, the new glass movement, or the art glass movement, as we call it, is really in its infancy. It's only in the last 30 to 40 years that artists have really been beginning to explore this medium as a fine arts and artistic medium. So I think to broadly categorize glass as art or craft, I think is a little bit naive. I think that it depends on the person using it and how it's being used. And I believe, of course, I'm a glass artist, I believe glass can soar to the level of fine art. And I think we're just beginning to nibble at that, really. We've just started to explore it as a fine arts material.
If you're just joining us, my guest is glass artist Steve Gibbs. He's one of the creative forces at the Corning Museum of Glass. Now, let's talk about some of these amazing programs that you've developed at the Corning Museum of Glass. The 2300 Degrees Show. Tell us about how you incorporated glass with art and food. And
well, we are always looking for refreshing things to do and ways to share our passion for this mystical and magical material glass at the Corning Museum of Glass. And we always do some wonderful openings for many of the shows, glass shows that we have every year at the Corning Museum. But one day I was talking with my boss and we were kind of thinking about how we could reach maybe a younger audience that maybe in a little bit less traditional way and make glass accessible for them. So we thought, geez, if we were going to host a bunch of our friends, what would we do? And we thought, well, we would invite them to our studio. We'd do some demonstrations and kind of show them what we were working on at the time. We'd probably have some refreshments, and we'd probably have a little bit of music. So that was kind of the genesis of 2300 Degrees. And now 2300 Degrees has grown to one of the larger community events in the Finger Lakes region, and very vibrant, and we kind of mix up organic amalgam of music, glass, refreshments, and most of all, great people, the community. And we try to have fun for a couple hours on the third Thursday of the month. So it's kind of the mix, and there's really no formula to the mix. We always are doing things differently. We get bored very easily, so we're always looking for something new. So there's always a new culture and a new glass technique and a new little bit of music and always great friends that make 2300 Degrees happen.
Mm-hmm. Are you trying to attract people to take on the profession, or what's the reason to attract people to the idea of glass?
Well, it's interesting. It's our mission, and in a nutshell, I can read a one-page sheet and tell you the same thing, but the Corning Museum of Glass, our mission is to tell the world about glass. Mm. It's a way for us to tell people about this mystical and magical material. I'm kind of a glass evangelist, and I guess I can't help myself, but just to talk a little bit about that, one of the things that happens, especially this time of the year, in our region where it's kind of cold and frosty, there's nothing on a cold day to attract a crowd like a nice hot glass furnace. It's kind of like, it's almost like being in the wilderness or out camping, the way people are kind of attracted to a campfire. Mm. The difference is that with glass, we can take this, I call it liquid fire sometimes, and we can sculpt it, change it, and make something beautiful right in front of people's very eyes out of this kind of gob of glowing, you know, lava. So it tends to be a very primal and visceral kind of attraction that people that have for glass, and I certainly feel that, and I think the tens of thousands of visitors that come to the Corning Museum every year feel that same visceral, primal attraction, and I think it could be as simple as sand, which of course glass is made from, and fire.
And what kind of response, I know you've taken the hot glass show all around the world, what kind of response do you get from the world where glass actually started, the old world?
Well, it's very interesting. Our most recent foray into the old world has been to Bordeaux, France. We've spent quite a bit of time in Bordeaux the last couple of years teaching glassmaking there. And it seems to be very popular there as well, too. At first, when we started traveling, you know, our staff always felt very comfortable being in Corning. Everybody knew Corning was all about glass. It was in context, so we felt safe there. We had friendly audiences there, and it worked out very well for us. When we started traveling around the world, it was a little bit intimidating. We didn't know. It's like we know everybody loves us in Corning, but how about when we go to France or when we go to Australia Or when I was really scared was kind of when we went to the Olympic Games in Salt Lake City.
Mm.
So we kind of faced both the old world and the new world in Salt Lake City. And we found that people loved glass in Salt Lake City from all over the world and in France every bit as much as we do. Now we feel very confident and very safe virtually going anywhere in the world blowing glass.
So glass is a universal language.
I think it can be, yes.
Uh-huh.
I think it can be. And in our most ambitious mission, which we haven't completed yet, is we're working currently with Celebrity Cruise Lines. And we're going to be building 4 glass studios on 4 different huge ships around the world and blowing glass at sea for Celebrity Cruise Lines. So that's a new adventure that I'll tell you about in about a year.
Now, I understand that you still consider yourself a student of glass blowing. Is one constantly finding new things to learn about this art?
Well, I find that more and more to be true. I find that if we listen to the material, listen to others, there's always something new to learn. When I was first starting in the Steuben Glass Factory in Corning about, I guess it was 25 years ago or so, the people told me that were working there, some of the old gaffers, that they were still learning every day. Some of them were in their late 60s and had been working with glass for 40-plus years, and they said they still learned little things every day, that the glass would teach them things. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about glass is we've just really started to discover this material, even though, you know, telescopes made with glass lenses can take us out into outer space, and microscopes can look at little tiny amoebas and take us into the cellular world. I still think there's a lot to discover with glass, and I find that with my work every day, and I find that in talking with other glass artists, that they're still learning every day. So I think that's part of the attraction of this material, is that it reveals its secrets slowly, and we still have a lot more to discover. So it's fun when you're learning.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if most people who are getting involved in glass are hoping that their stuff will be creative enough to be in museums, or are they trying to make utilitarian objects for people's lives?
I think it's a real mix. I think more and more, I think with the popularity of glass and glass showing up in more and more fine arts venues, famous museums around the world, I think that we all love to dream, and I think many people that are beginning to explore glass do envision themselves as being the next Pablo Picasso or something, and taking it to a place, hopefully, that's never been imagined before. But certainly most of the glass that's made today, probably about 95% of the glass that's made today, is made by a machine for some type of industrial type of application, be it window glass or beverage bottles or whatever we require in our everyday life. So certainly both activities are alive and well, but I think in the last 30 years, there's been more activity on the fine arts side of glassmaking than there ever has been in the history of the world. So it's kind of interesting.
Hmm. Now, schools don't teach glassmaking. There's no curriculum for people to go to in schools. How would somebody, if they were really interested in becoming a glass artist, where would they go?
Well, there are several ways to learn, actually. More and more, there are universities that are presenting glassmaking as a curriculum,
really?
Believe it or not. Yes, both in this country and in Europe. One of the most accredited ones close by, there are two actually, the Rochester Institute of Technology has a wonderful glassmaking program, as well as Alfred University. They also have a glassmaking curriculum. So you can learn it in school, and it's a great way to learn. Many of the glassblowers that come to us in Corning and work with us sometimes are from that type of an academic background. Another way to learn, and this is probably a more practical way for a lot of people because, of course, it's very expensive, would be to just start what I call the first rule of business, start showing up at someone's studio and kind of show an interest and maybe begin by sweeping the floor for free and eventually work it up. And someday they won't have an assistant or something that they need, and they'll tell you to, hey, jump in here. We need you to help us out. And one thing leads to another, and that's a great way to learn. The other thing to do would be to get a job at a studio or in some type of an industrial factory where they're blowing glass by hand, which, of course, is pretty rare in this country.
I was going to say, yeah.
But it's another great way to learn. There's no substitute in glassmaking. It's kind of like Glassmaking in many ways can be likened to playing a musical instrument. You have to repeat things over and over and over again. And working in an industrial setting, blowing pieces, making pieces of glass, it really allows you to hone your skills with that with the repetitive nature of the work. It can be boring, it can be laborious, but we found some of the strongest glass makers come from an industrial background.
Now, do you teach?
We do teach. I teach various classes. What I spend the most time on is actually team teaching a course in Bordeaux, France, at a place called Bois Boucher, where we teach glass design theory, the theory of designing with glass. And it's really being sensitive to the material and working with it and taking advantage of its physical properties, its ability to stretch, its ability to both be liquid and solid. It's a glass design course. So that's primarily what I do. But at the Corning Museum, the Hot Glass Show, even though it seems like fun and entertainment, which it is, it's really an educational program. So it's the kind of, I think it's education at its best, in that our demonstrations at the Corning Museum of Glass are fun, and sometimes we don't even realize that we're learning something, and we are. So that's good. So yes, I would say that probably the class that helped me the most when I was in college, I thought it would be a good idea to get provisional teaching certification when I was in school, and I did. And I think that's probably some of the most useful knowledge I acquired in college, and it was the one that I thought I would be least likely to use.
Now, do you have advice for people who are thinking about becoming glass artists? What would you tell them?
I guess I would tell them to try to ally themselves with the best people they can in the field, and also to start drawing and start working and start doing it. There's no substitute for experience and waiting for the perfect idea or the perfect plan or the perfect opportunity will probably never happen. So getting started today with what you have and using what you have in a creative way instead of waiting for the best equipment or the best opportunity, I guess is the advice that I would give to get out there and make something happen. And I guess most of all, have fun with it.
And just go for it.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. Anything new coming up in Steve Gibbs's creative imagination? All these shows that you've created. Anything else you're coming up with?
Well, I mentioned the shipboard thing. I think that's one of the things that I'm going to be most fascinated with, and we'll be mixing, being that the ships are based not only in the U.S., but also spending about three-quarters of the year in Europe, around the Mediterranean and around Northern Europe. It'll be integrating the various, glassmaking has various cultures. So on board the ship, we'll be taking advantage of and demonstrating the various cultures of glass. So we're in the process of formulating that right now, and I'm very excited about it.
Well, Steve Gibbs, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and please, everybody, go visit the Corning Museum of Glass and meet this man. Go look at some of these demonstrations. The place is fascinating. Thank you, Steve.
Great. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.